Normally I would have given you your data link forms back, but I forgot them in my office, so I'll do that next time. And I'll also show you the test next time after a lecture. Now, so I know some of you can't stay, but many of you can, and there's plenty of time after lecture, so you can take a look at the test then. The following time, I'll also put it up at the beginning for anyone who wants to look at it at the beginning. And if neither of those works, then be sure to click on my office hours link on my website to make other arrangements to look at the test. All right, we need to go on to Unit 2 now, starting with this, I guess it's Chapter 5, is it? Chapter 5 is about energy. Energy is an important concept, not only in biology, but definitely in biology. When you go about defining what an organism is, really what you're doing is listing several things that living things have in common, right? Like high degree of order, growth, reproduction, and so on. Well, in that list of things that living things have in common is the processing of energy. And so energy is central to biology, really. And we're going to talk much more about it, not just in this chapter. But energy is kind of a mysterious thing. It's often defined by textbooks as the ability to do some sort of work, right? Or more specifically, the ability to cause some sort of change, whether it's chemical change or physical change. Energy is involved in doing that. And so the work that we're talking about in biology comes in six major categories. That's the purpose of this first slide. We see the six major categories of biological work. In other words, these are the things that cells need energy in order to perform. So there's synthetic work. Now, synthesis, syn meaning together, refers to bringing things together. Synthetic work means bringing smaller molecules together to form bigger ones. And so in terms of the metabolic dichotomy, what part of metabolism is synthetic work? Anabolism, correct. Photosynthesis is shown here as an example of synthetic work because that's what plants do. Plants create the organic compounds out of inorganic compounds, simpler structures. CO2 is inorganic, even though it contains carbon, right? No carbon-hydrogen bonds. To produce the sugars that photosynthesis spits out means you have to synthesize molecules. You have to anabolize, and that requires energy. Mechanical work is next. All sorts of examples of that. This guy lifting the barbell is an example, but there's mechanical work even within a single cell, right? When things move around, that's mechanical work. That motor protein carrying the vesicle along the microtubule that I showed you in a previous chapter would be an example of mechanical work. Your muscles working at the cellular level is mechanical work because there's an increase in overlap between proteins. That's why your muscle cells get shorter. Concentration work refers to the establishment of a concentration gradient. Now, what is a gradient in general? Not just a concentration gradient, but what does the word gradient mean? A gradient refers to a difference. So there's all kinds of gradients, like a pressure gradient, right? The reason that the water always comes out of the faucet whenever you turn the valve is because there's a pressure gradient in place. If there weren't, no water would come out. But there's higher pressure inside than outside, and therefore the water flows down its pressure gradient. Concentration gradient simply means a difference in concentration between two points. And For organisms, those 2 points are inside the cell and outside the cell, or at least on one side of a membrane and on the other side of a membrane. It could be a membrane of an organelle rather than just a plasma membrane. But concentration work refers to stockpiling those particles, whatever they are, on one side of the membrane compared to the other, and therefore creating that gradient to begin with. That's the expensive part. Gradients want to dissipate, in a sense. In other words, when a gradient is in place, that's a more disordered, that's a more unstable, scenario. Things want to tend to more stable states. And so it doesn't take energy to allow diffusion to happen down a gradient, but it takes energy to force those particles, whatever they are, ions or molecules, against their gradient, to create the gradient to begin with. And so that's concentration work. Electrical work is shown next. Well, this is kind of a subset of concentration work. Ions carry charge, of course, electrical charge. And so if you establish a gradient of ions, then you're not only establishing a chemical gradient, because those ions are chemicals, a concentration gradient of chemicals, you're also creating a gradient with respect to electrical charge, because each of those particles is carrying a charge. And that, of course, takes energy as well. Now, all the cells of your body have a charge across their membrane. That doesn't just happen. A major fraction of your energy budget goes into causing that to be the case. Your sodium-potassium exchange pumps establish that electrochemical gradient across the plasma membrane of each cell. And that takes like 40% of your energy budget just to do that continuously. 40% of the reason you eat, in other words, is to create that electrochemical gradient. That's useful, though, because that can cause all sorts of other things to happen once it's in place. Heat production is E, the fifth one listed here. Heat is often considered, in a sense, waste energy because there's nothing you can do about its creation. It's part of inefficiency in a thermodynamic process. And by comparison with an internal combustion engine, you would like for your engine not to heat up, because that heat that's created is energy that is not being used to propel you down the road. If it were 100% efficient process, then every bit of energy in that fuel originally that you're releasing would propel you. Doesn't come close to all of it. It doesn't approach half, really. So heat is often considered waste. So nothing you can do about it, and that's why you have to have a dedicated cooling system just to keep your engine running, because of all this waste heat energy. But there's sometimes when you actually want to produce heat as well in your own body. For instance, you produce heat naturally, but sometimes you want to produce heat even more because you need the temperature to be elevated so that your various proteins have the right shapes. In other words, to maintain a body temperature. And shivering does just that. Normally we use the contraction of muscles to move bones in a coordinated manner. Shivering uses the muscles for a different reason. It just uncoordinatedly contracts them simply so that they will produce frictional heat just to warm you up rather than to move your muscles. And bioluminescence is the sixth. Refers to organisms that actually produce light. Now, actually, we're all producing light. Every object in the universe is producing light continuously. It's just not humanly visible light. Right? I'm radiating light to you. You're receiving that light. You're radiating light to me. It's just invisible light. It's infrared light. Here we're talking about actual humanly visible light, invisible to other organisms as well. Not everything can do this, but these fireflies can, and others can as well. That's caused by chemical reactions, but not for free. It requires energy. All of these six categories of biological work require energy in one form or another. If we go to slide 2, we can talk about energy with respect to an ecosystem. In any given ecosystem, there is a flow through of energy. In other words, energy enters an ecosystem and energy exits an ecosystem, but it's not in the same form when it exits. It enters as sunlight in the vast majority of cases and then gets transformed and transferred, transformed meaning changed to other sorts of energy, like chemical energy or heat. Transferred means it gets passed from one object in that ecosystem to another, and this happens over and over, but eventually energy leaves the ecosystem as heat. Coming in as sunlight, coming out as heat. So there's a flow through of energy. Whereas for materials, they stay largely within the ecosystem and just get passed around from object to object. And, you know, the atoms become parts of different molecules as these changes take place, but most of them stay within the ecosystem. The ecosystem ceases to function if you don't have a continuous flow through of energy, though, which is why without the sunlight, we're not going to be here. Besides that major point, though, what this figure is showing you is the reciprocal relationship between phototrophs and chemotrophs. A phototroph is an organism that uses sunlight as the energy source to produce organic molecules. Phototrophs are autotrophs. Autotrophs are producers. They produce their own food. I mean, they produce food for themselves using some sort of energy source. The vast majority of autotrophs are phototrophs. There are some chemoautotrophs as well that use chemical energy as the source of energy to produce their organic molecules. But almost all the autotrophs are phototrophs. Not just plants, but anything that's photosynthetic. Chemotrophs, on the other hand, use chemical energy as their energy source to power their various cellular work activities that we just talked about. And so what photosynthesis really does is it converts light energy from sunlight into chemical energy of those organic compounds that are produced. And once you have organic compounds, then there can be all kinds of interconversions between compounds using some of that chemical energy along the way. Right? We get energy from our food because that food is really just the bodies of other organisms, organic molecules that wouldn't exist if some autotroph hadn't assembled them for us. We can't get any usable energy out of carbon dioxide, but we can out of organic compounds. Those organic compounds need to be synthesized. Photosynthesis, as the name indicates, is the original source of that synthesis for us.
All right, so organic compounds are produced by phototrophs. They are then broken down into the raw materials again. CO2 and water are what plants use as their raw materials for photosynthesis. That produces organic compounds, which can be interconverted not only within that plant. I mean, the plant is not trying to feed us, right? It's feeding itself. But it feeds the rest of the world as well, because we then eat those organic compounds and reverse the process, disassemble those organic compounds, break those skeletons back down, get the usable energy out of it. Some of it's lost as heat, of course, but what you have left after that process is CO2 again. All right? And so there's a reciprocal relationship between the complete oxidation of fuels, and which is what we do, and the production of those fuels, which is what photosynthesis accomplishes. Okay, let's go to three and talk briefly about thermodynamic systems. Thermodynamics is a important field for many scientists, but it's important within biology as well when we talk about energy. And we can define three different categories, even though only two are shown here. There are three major categories of thermodynamic systems. Before defining those, let's just say what a system is. A thermodynamic system can be just about anything you want it to be. It could be this room. It could be your body. It could be a single cell. It could be a chemical reaction. It could be a planet. Really anything, as long as you say beforehand what it is. So a thermodynamic system is really just some predefined subset of the universe. And it might have an actual boundary, a physical barrier that is a boundary, or just a conceptual one. Like if I say a chemical reaction is a system, which it is an example of a system, doesn't really actually have a boundary, right? Except just conceptually. Well, anyway, when you define a thermodynamic system, whatever it is, you're really breaking the universe into two pieces. The system itself, whatever you say that is, and everything else, which collectively are called the surroundings. So, the universe equals the system and the surroundings. There are, as I said, three kinds of thermodynamic systems: open systems, closed systems, and isolated systems. An isolated system is a thermodynamic system that, as the name indicates, is totally apart from the rest of the universe, from the surroundings. And there, what that means is that an isolated system is unable to exchange energy or matter with the surroundings. And that's really just a concept. There's really no such thing as a truly isolated system, but sometimes it's useful to talk about. A little less severe is a closed system. A closed system, thermodynamically speaking, is a system that can exchange energy but not matter with the surroundings. And this is what's being represented here. You have this thing. The system here is the whatever's in this black cylinder, a gray cylinder. Now there's a plant in the bottle, but then the bottle's enclosed as well. There's no exchange of matter between this system and the surroundings. There is an exchange of energy, though, because you can conduct heat into or out of it, for instance, radiate heat away. So that's a closed system. An open system is the only other possibility. An open system can exchange both energy and matter with the surroundings. And hopefully it's already clear to you that any organism, and you can define any organism as a system, because you can define anything as a system. Any organism is not just a system, it has to be an open system.
just based on what we've already said about living things. Living things require a continuous processing of energy. So there's always going to be an exchange of energy. That alone isn't enough, though. There also has to be an exchange of materials continuously, right? Certain things have to be brought into the organism. Certain things need to be gotten rid of. And there has to be an exchange of energy as well. So all living organisms are open systems, thermodynamically speaking. Yeah.
I'm just curious. So would an example of a closed system be a while back when they drilled down the ice in Antarctica, and it was a Russian drill, and to this lake at the bottom that was basically separating light, oxygen for millions of years, but the organisms still were able to evolve. Is that considered a closed system, or is that still an open system?
Still an open system because there's... first of all, if there's any life, it has to be open because you can't have... It depends on how big a thing is. You know, you can say that the entire Earth is a system. And if it's not really exchanging appreciable matter with the rest of the universe, I guess you could call that closed. But then it becomes less useful in terms of thermodynamics. There has to be, though, exchange of matter, not just energy. It's not enough to just exchange energy because you have to have these interconversions of compounds. Yeah.
What about the stuff that was, like you said, that there were plant gen?
Well, this is the point. An organism as a system has to be open. Now, an organism that is a part of a much, much bigger system, that's more than just the organism. I'm saying if you define your system as the organism, and that's the boundary, the organism, that has to be open. Right? If you define the entire universe as your system, okay, it's isolated. But an organism isn't the whole system there. That's just part of the system. Okay, but anyway... That's the definition of thermodynamic systems. We should, before I actually speak about four, we should bother, since we mentioned thermodynamics, to talk about the laws of thermodynamics. There are how many laws of thermodynamics? There are four, but confusingly, they are not called first, second, third, and fourth law. They're called the zeroth, the first, the second, and the third law. And that's because after the first, second, and third were already laid down, people realized, actually, we need something even more basic here that we should stick in the beginning. So instead of renumbering, which would have confused everyone, they termed it the zeroth law. Well, the zeroth and the fourth don't really apply so much to biology, so we don't talk about those in biology classes usually. It's the first and the second law. The ones that are called the first and the second law that really apply, and those are the ones that you probably know. What is the first law of thermodynamics? Yeah, that's the first law of thermodynamics is often called the law of conservation of energy, right? States that the total amount of energy in the universe is constant. Energy can't be created or destroyed. It can only be transferred or transformed, which occurs all the time, like I talked about, in an ecosystem. But however much energy you have, that's what there is. It can't be created or destroyed. What about the second law? What's that have to do with? What major concept?
With every energy transfer that occurs, increases the entropy or chaos.
Right. Entropy is the major point of the second law of thermodynamics. Entropy, not enthalpy. Entropy is, roughly speaking, disorder, randomness. And so the second law tells us that in any given transaction, any process, the total amount of entropy in the universe has to increase, which is another way of saying that the universe is always becoming more and more disordered. And at first blush, it might seem that organisms are a violation of that law, because one of those hallmarks of life, the things that we define living organisms by, is a high degree of order. So they are not disordered. They have a very high degree of order. They're not the only things in the universe that have a high degree of order, but they're good examples. And they maintain that high degree of order throughout their life. Well, that doesn't violate the second law of thermodynamics, because the organism isn't the entire universe, right? So it is possible for some little subset, a system, of the universe to increase in order. In other words, to decrease in entropy. But only if there's an even greater increase in disorder, increase in entropy, elsewhere in the surroundings. So we become more ordered than we would be if we weren't organisms, only because the surroundings, somewhere in the rest of the universe, becomes even more disordered. And therefore, as a whole, the universe is becoming more and more disordered. So it's a winding down. Eventually, it will be entirely disordered. That's probably going to be after I retire. So in slide 4, we're looking at some compounds on the top that from left to right are shown in decreasing order of availability of energy to an organism. So these are less and less useful fuels for powering the various kinds of biological work that cells have to perform. These things are becoming more and more oxidized as we go to the right. All right, so fuels, the chemical energy that makes fuels is mostly energy that can be obtained or extracted for useful cellular work by undergoing oxidation reactions. And so you have to think back about what redox reactions are all about. Redox is, remember, shorthand for reduction oxidation. So you always, these go hand in hand. In any redox reaction, something is being reduced, something is being oxidized. It's not that you have just reduction or just oxidation. But which is which? What does reduction refer to? No. Right. The gain of electrons. It's kind of confusing terminology, because reduction usually refers to the removal of something, right? Reduction is the gain of electrons. The reason the word reduction makes sense is that electrons are carrying negative charge, right? So reduction is going to decrease the charge of that thing that's being reduced because of those extra negatives. At least partially extra electrons. It's not necessarily a complete gain of electrons or a complete loss of electrons in the case of oxidation. It can be partial. All right. Well, this is why fuels, things that make good organic fuels, have a lot of carbon-hydrogen bonds in them. Just like the gasoline that you burn in an internal combustion engine has a bunch of carbon-hydrogen bonds, right? Gasoline is a mixture of various alkanes. Alkanes are things that have nothing but carbon-hydrogen bonds in them, right? Well, why does a carbon-hydrogen bond have such usefulness as a fuel? It's because of what we've already talked about in terms of, we discussed this in terms of polar versus nonpolar molecules already, right? Carbon and hydrogen have just about the same electronegativity. And therefore, a carbon-hydrogen bond, which is covalent, is a pretty equal sharing of that pair of electrons that is being shared in each single bond. All right, that means that the electrons aren't particularly close to either of the two nuclei that are involved. And the farther an electron is from a nucleus, the higher energy level it's at, right? The more unstable it is, the farther away it is from the nucleus. Well, by oxidizing a fuel, what you're really doing is allowing the electrons that were being equally shared by carbon and hydrogen to be less equally shared. And therefore, for those electrons to get closer to one of the two nuclei and become more stable in the process. All right? So the electrons lose energy as they go down in energy level, as they become associated with one nucleus more than the other. Well, the first law tells you that that energy is not destroyed. So if energy level goes down in a compound, that means energy must be released by that process, that oxidation process. So notice on the far right here, you have carbon dioxide, which as a fuel is worthless to us. If you look at alkane, alcohol, aldehyde, carboxylic acid, and then carbon dioxide, notice that as you go to the right, each of these has fewer and fewer carbon-hydrogen bonds. And so this is what we do with our carbon-carbon bonds, for that matter, which are also valuable, right, in terms of sharing. So what we do with our fuels, which each fuel molecule is a carbon skeleton with hydrogens in there as well, is we dissemble the carbon skeleton. However many carbons there were to begin with, we pick that totally apart so that there's just one carbon, and we pick off all of the hydrogens, replacing them with oxygen. Oxygen, with its high electronegativity, greedily grabs for those electrons, and now those electrons are closer to one of the two atomic nuclei. That's more stability. And that releases energy. All right? So carbon dioxide, we can't get any more usable energy out of that. It's not that that molecule doesn't contain any energy, just we can't get to it. We can get to the energy in the carbon-hydrogen bonds of fuels, though, by oxidation reactions. And so oxidation is the removal of electrons, just the opposite of reduction. Well, slide 5 shows you what overall molecule here. This is a triglyceride, also called what? It's not a fatty acid. It can go by any of three interchangeable names, one of which is triglyceride. What's the easiest one to spell? Fat, yes. Or triacylglycerol, correct. Those are three interchangeable words. Remember, one glycerol molecule that has undergone three condensation reactions, one of each with three different fatty acids, to sew the whole thing together into a fat. Well, the fatty acids, which are the tails of this thing, are really good sources of stored energy because they are hydrocarbons. Nothing but carbon-carbon bonds and carbon-hydrogen bonds, except at the very tip where they were sewn onto the glycerol molecule. So this is exactly why fatty acids are such valuable fuel stores, right? Those electrons that are being shared by the carbons and the hydrogens, or by the carbon and the carbon, are equally shared and therefore in an unstable condition. They're not very close to either of the two atomic nuclei. So notice they're labeled as reduced. These are highly reduced molecules, meaning they can be oxidized. That's how we use our fuels, by oxidizing them. That's how we get the energy out of them. Okay. Six. We have a graph of delta G here. And delta G, well, let me just start with G. What is G?
Gibbs free energy,
sometimes just called free energy, but that the reason the symbol is G is because Gibbs came up with the idea. And free energy, or G, has some value for any given system at any given point in time. So G is the absolute value, it's the value absolutely of whatever the free energy is of that system at that moment. And the free energy is, that's really just the usable energy that's in a system. That's the G by itself is really not so useful biologically to us as the delta G value for a given process. So for delta G, there has to be a before and an after, right? An initial value of G, in other words, and a final value of G, before and after the process, which could be a chemical reaction, for instance, often is. Delta G is calculated as what? Well, yeah, delta means change, but how do you actually calculate delta?
Final.
Right, it's final minus initial. So delta G equals G final minus G initial. And so, defined that way mathematically, that means delta G is going to be negative when? When the initial is higher than the final, right? Because when you subtract initial, which is bigger, from final, which is smaller, that means that's going to make that value negative, right? Well, notice that delta G thermodynamically is defined as delta H minus T delta S. Delta H is the enthalpy, or the heat of reaction. T is absolute temperature, importantly. Not centigrade temperature, absolute temperature, which is non-negative always, right? And for all practical purposes, it's not only non-negative, it's always positive, right? So Kelvins. And then delta S. What is delta S? Change in what?
Entropy.
So that is the thermodynamic mathematical definition of delta G. But the practical interpretation of delta G is far more important to biology. Delta G, the value of delta G, allows you to tell whether any given process is spontaneous or not. It's either spontaneous or non-spontaneous, right? So what does spontaneity refer to? Well, it refers to whether that process can happen on its own. In other words, whether the internal energy of that system is enough to cause that process to occur. Spontaneous reactions will occur. Non-spontaneous reactions won't occur on their own ever. But spontaneity has nothing to do with how readily a reaction or a process will occur. So there are plenty of examples of spontaneous processes that aren't necessarily going to happen in your lifetime. Right? You might have to wait thousands of years for it to happen, but if it will happen eventually, it's spontaneous by definition, okay? Well, what the boxes on these graph represents is the fact that the overall value of delta G is going to depend on the values of delta H and the values of T delta S, or if you want to define it that way, of negative T delta S. because delta H minus T delta S is really the same thing as delta H plus negative T delta S, right? So these bars within each little box here give you the components, negative T delta S. Well, if what this means is that there's, whether delta G is positive or negative really depends on these two addends and their sign. But whatever delta H and negative T delta S are, if delta G, which is the sum of those, is negative, what can we say for sure?
Spontaneous.
That process is spontaneous and can occur on its own, even though it might not do so very anytime soon. If delta G is positive, that means it's not going to occur on its own. You're going to have to force that thing to happen somehow. Okay? So, if delta, the things in green on the bottom, those are all negative delta G values, so those represent spontaneous processes. Well, the process can be spontaneous because delta H itself is negative, and so is negative T delta S. Of course, when you add those together, delta G is going to be negative. But it could also be that one of them is positive and one of them is negative, but if the negative one is bigger in magnitude than the positive one and you add them together, you're still going to get a negative. That's the point here. Of course, if they're both positive, then you're certainly going to have a positive delta G, and therefore a non-spontaneous process, whatever that is, whether it's a reaction or otherwise. Okay, so let's look at an example of how the delta G notation is used in slide 7. Here we have free energy, not delta G, free energy, G, for two different reactions, the oxidation of glucose in green and the synthesis of glucose in red. They are the reverse of each other. Okay? To oxidize glucose is to use it as fuel and break that six carbon skeleton down into six individual carbon dioxides. And the complete oxidation of glucose, which is includes not only glycolysis in your cells. I mean, you could do this just by burning the glucose directly. But how this happens in your cells is by glycolysis first and then cellular respiration after that to complete the oxidation all the way to carbon dioxide and water. If that's done, the delta G is negative, notice, and the magnitude of that tells you how much energy is liberated, 686 kilocalories per mole. On the other hand, if you start out with carbon dioxide in water, which is what the plant has as its raw materials, and produce that glucose via photosynthesis first and then joining simple three carbon sugars that photosynthesis directly produces into a six carbon sugar of glucose, that is exactly the reverse in terms of energy. And therefore, it's 686 kilocalories per mole again, but this time it's positive. So the oxidation of glucose is a spontaneous reaction, or set of reactions in this case, whereas the synthesis of glucose is non-spontaneous. Now, non-spontaneous reactions happen all the time in biology, but they never can happen on their own for thermodynamic reasons if they are non-spontaneous. So how is it that we're able to cause non-spontaneous reactions to occur?
Enzymes.
Enzymes are involved. First of all, we have to provide energy. Without provision of energy, it's just not going to take place. But we also couple sets of reactions all the time in our cells. We couple some reaction that is spontaneous to another reaction that's non-spontaneous, and therefore use some of the energy that the spontaneous reaction gives up in order to drive the reaction that's non-spontaneous. Now, there are three pairs of words that kind of go hand in hand when we're talking about all of this. spontaneous and non-spontaneous, that's one pair of antonyms, right? They're opposites of each other. And that those words are just refer to whether or not a process is going to occur on its own at some time. But that's related to endergonic and exergonic as another set of antonyms. An exergonic reaction or process is one that releases energy when that process occurs. Ex meaning out, and ergon meaning energy. Whereas an endergonic process is one that requires energy for it to occur. And then the third set of antonyms is catabolic and anabolic. Even though there's not a perfect, there are some exceptions, very few exceptions though. In general, a catabolic reaction, which takes big thing and breaks it into small pieces, usually that is going to be exergonic. Yields energy, which is why we do this to our fuels, right? We break our fuels into smaller pieces so that we can get energy out of them. Whereas the synthesis of larger compounds out of smaller ones, which is anabolic, usually requires energy. All right? Well, we have to build macromolecules all the time in our cells, right? We don't take any proteins into our body when we eat, for instance. We tend to say that we do when we talk in dietary terms. No such thing as taking proteins into your body. We put proteins and other mixtures of macronutrients into our alimentary canal, which is not in our body, right? We're wrapped around that tube. We digest the protein while it's still outside of our body into amino acids, which are then taken into our body. We use those as raw materials to build our own proteins out of those building blocks according to the instructions in our DNA. Doing that requires a bunch of energy. Assembling those amino acids takes energy. Where do we get that energy? By oxidizing the fuel that we also take in from our food. So we couple those exergonic reactions that yield energy from our fuels to endergonic reactions that require energy in order for them to happen. 8. KEQ is introduced in this slide. We have free energy on the y-axis, but on the bottom we have the molar ratio. And this is, in this case, it's the ratio of B concentration to A concentration in a theoretical reaction of whatever A is being converted into B. It's a reversible reaction, notice. Well, K by itself, without the EQ, is just a ratio of concentrations, right? Ratio of the concentration of the products over the concentration of the reactants. KEQ is the value of K at equilibrium for that process, for that reaction. And notice from the red curve here that at that special value of K called KEQ, which in this case is 1, it wouldn't have to be 1, but in this case it's just 1, wherever the equilibrium value is, the free energy value is minimized. So processes tend toward equilibrium because they are minimizing their free energy at that point. They're becoming most stable. The higher the value of G, the higher the value of instability. And so spontaneous processes occur because whatever that process is tending toward greater stability. In this example, if you started out with pure A, you didn't have any B at all, some B is going to be made by that. A is going to turn into B, a certain amount, right? The more that happens, the more you have of B and the less you have of A. Well, eventually there will become a point where the production of A into B exactly equals the rate of production of B into A. When those two equal each other, then you've come to equilibrium. All right, and that value, that molar ratio value, gets the special name KEQ. So that's the relationship between G and KEQ. Now, not all reactions have a KEQ that's right in the middle here. If it's a bigger value of KEQ, shift it over here to the right, that you would still, though, have a minimum value of G at that KEQ. So you'd have a curve that reaches its nadir, or lowest point, at KEQ for any given reaction.